And with that, we'll move on to item 5, Executive Officer's Report.
Good afternoon, almost evening, Chairman Coxon and board members. We have two EO reports for you this month in your packet, and a late addition because there were two good news stories that we forgot to add in. One reporting on the land disturbance variances that we give to allow people to do construction just a bit longer before the rains hit so they can get their projects buttoned down, if you will, to fix last-minute things before the winter rains hit. The other one is on a good news from Caltrans and our staff working together. And, you know, we do have some good projects with Caltrans, and so some of them were around Lake Tahoe, and so there's a nice write-up on that that you might enjoy. I wanted to highlight some things in the report because I think there's some interesting things these two reports over the last 2 months. One is our performance targets, which we gave a summary of. It is only the inspections piece of it. It's not the actual permitting of the facilities. And in case you're looking for that, that is on Bait Stamps 5-9. And the main takeaway from this is how impressive the work that all the staff did and all these facilities. We really blown past by a large margin our performance targets. And if you wonder why those numbers are so high, is also because we do follow-ups. You know, often on problem sites is to be expected. You know, you go there once. If there's issues, you go back and make sure it's taken care of. So it really is a credit to the staff. Our region has complexities that other regions don't have. The vast size of our region means sometimes staff spend an entire day driving to and back from an inspection, so that, which makes, in my humble opinion, this all the more impressive. There's a typo in there. We actually did 321 inspections, not 326, but it's still pretty good. Because that includes our 401 CERT programs is something we do not report to the state board right now, although they're talking about having that in the future. So, you know, again, I just want to shout out to staff for all the great work they did on the day-to-day basis. So I just wanted you to see those. Another report that's in written form is the Silver King Creek Rotnum Project. This is now year 3 that we've gone out with Department of Fish and Wildlife to assist them on this project. Our own Don Jardine went last year but couldn't make it this year. And the good news I wanted to highlight is that none of the rotenone nor the permanganate were detected below the boundary line. So they did some better management practices. Last year we had a little bit of issue. I am told that we hope to believe that this is the last time they will do that. They're trying to dispense with the native, with invasive species of rainbow trout to try to restock the Paiute cutthroat trout. Another report in there is our El Nino report, and it's really focused on San Bernardino County. And the reason I wanted to highlight to you is that throughout our region, our staff are working with the individual counties. You know, this is a report on one county where likely will be heavily hit by heavy rains, but all of our counties are working with our staff, with the local OES, to work in preparations for El Nino. And there will be a letter going out from the state board shortly to sanitary sewers and other facilities, basically to tell them they really need to prepare their sites for potential heavy rains. They need to button them up. They need to make sure they have all contingencies in place so that we're prepared. So that will go out to many, many dischargers throughout the state from the state board. Of course, they will work with us. They'll contact us if they have questions. But it's good to kind of remind people that you need to be prepared We're also working with the Corps of Engineers on dredge and fill. You know, if you do have a flood and you have a mess afterwards, what are some of the complexities of the permitting to deal with that? So that, there's a lot of back and forth now with the Corps and the State Board and the regions about how to make that a, you know, a seamless process given the limitations of the law and our permitting authorities. The other thing is, it was a really good idea when our board adopted early in the year. As you recall, we expanded our traditional emergency fire waiver to all emergencies. So it's good that we have that in place. I know that staff will be sharing that with the counties as they have these meetings to let them know if there is ever a bad situation in housing and buildings and others are destroyed and they need to dispose of them, what are the steps they need to take. So that's a little update on there. I'm now still staying in the South, going to shift to the George Air Force Base. There's a nice write-up in my report on the good work that our staff have been doing, working with our sister agency, Toxix, on the Deldrin plume, which is under two school sites. One of the schools is closed, one is a charter school, 7 to 12. And Toxix is working with the Atlanta School District. And I'm hoping to have some meetings with the acting general manager at some point and hope to reach out to them and to Tuell's help. I thought I'd mention just a moment that, you know, Toxix has the lead in law for all the agencies to work with schools, predominantly the siting of new schools, so they put in safe locations. I'm sure you're not, well, you might be surprised to hear that many school has been sited on a hazardous waste site over the years. So that program is to help avoid that when we build or expand schools that we're careful about where we do that. They have limited funding to deal with existing schools, but they try their best at Toxix to look at, you know, indoor air issues, soil issues, and really the public health issues that are beyond the scope of the water board. So this is where we do a handoff to our sister agency to help us out, but we're working very closely with them. The city of Victorville. In our spill report, you'll notice it's on bait stamps 5-29, if you're curious. We responded to an 80,000-gallon spill from the city of Victorville on September 14th. It was subject to the Cal OES incident report, and John Morales from our Victorville office actually went out to look at the site. It was vandalism was the cause of that. They put a lot of it up a tire, all kinds of things in the manhole that backed up and it spilled. And it was into the Turner Wash. It was a tributary of the Mojave and a water of the U.S. After further analysis of what happens after a spill, they submit a report to us. We learned that the spill lasted longer than what was expected and was larger than was first anticipated. It is now 11 million gallons of raw sewage that spilled into the wash for 7 days before it was abated. Now, staff is working, you know, very closely, of course, with the city of Victorville and DWRA on improving spill reporting, potential, maybe, groundwater monitoring, maybe not. And the State Board has offered to help audit the program. So we're really working in collaboration to see how we can solve these problems in the future.
How is it that they didn't know that their sewer flows, their input was low?
Lori can answer that.
For the record, my employee, Kent Burr, Assistant Executive Officer. Just because Patty covered that, the facts, except that the time frame maybe was a little confusing there. So when John Morales went out there and saw them cleaning things up, the spill had ceased when he got out there. And they at the time had said, we think 80,000 gallons spilled into the wash on that on the night before and the day that he was out there. When they went back and actually looked at records, it turns out that because the city of Victorville collects wastewater for the city of Victorville, but then that wastewater goes to Victor Valley Wastewater Authority. Too bad Logan left, because I'm sure Logan can explain the details a little better. But it turns out that the telemetry and the pump station records is how... So when the city of Victorville put their report together and looked at all the details, after they actually started looking at the data that the Victor Valley Wastewater Authority collects, it was clear that they had lost 11 million gallons. And there should have been, I think there are procedures in place where VVWRA is supposed to notify the city of Victorville when they see these big changes in the flow in these pump stations. And something didn't happen. So this is something that, I don't know, Kim might cut me off at any moment now, but anyway, this is because bottom line is that I'm the head of the prosecution too. She's the advisor to the board. And
no one from Victorville is here.
And no one's from Victorville, so we can't have any ex parte conversations about this, but we are investigating these details, this full report. And the reference that Patty made, and this was, we felt like I could talk about this, is that this is all covered by the sanitary sewer overflow general permit the State Board issued several years ago. And it turns out that that permit requires a sewage spill management plan, so every entity must do one of these. And the City of Victorville has one. And it turns out that it's a little bit over 5 years old. I think it turns out the permit requires that this plan get updated every 5 years, and it was due for an update, and they're kind of working on one now. So I guess it's a good news part of that. But the bottom line is that because it's a statewide permit and there's someone in the Office of Enforcement who's been specializing in whether entities are actually complying with the statewide permit, like did the original plan actually comply with the permit? That's one question. That's the question the State Board staff is going to help us with. And then John Morales is looking at their spill report and their plan and saying, did they do what they said they were going to do in their plan? That's another question. And then at the same time, because the City of Victorville has said, hey, we're in the process of updating our plan, you know, we're hoping that all this information can be given to the city so they can give us a better plan moving forward. But in addition to all of that, we are also going to be evaluating whether or not to impose any type of penalty for the spill, because this type of spill where kids throw tires in the, we typically don't impose penalties if we think it was clearly just vandalism. In this case, the lack of response over that time period, you know, when there's available information that somehow wasn't communicated, that could put us in a situation where we would think it was appropriate to impose a penalty.
So spill response is required to have as a component spill detection.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay. All right. So
that's part of that new sanitary system.
That part was not working.
Yeah, and obviously different systems and different locations
and
systems.
Yeah, no, but 11 million gallons. I don't care what kind of system you have.
Right.
11 million gallons. 11 million gallons.
You can't prejudge what's
going on. It's hard to prejudge.
All right.
Okay,
so we'll hear more
about the question on that point. How long was this spill going on?
For like a week, 7 days.
Before they knew.
Yeah, before they, yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. Can someone explain to me why this is a fun thing to throw tires into the sewer? I'm sorry, it escapes me.
Yeah, I'm not sure why it's
vandalized. That wasn't a prank I did when I was a teenager. I don't know.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you, Lori, and I'm sorry for opening up the box, but I just wanted to at least let the board know that the number in my e-report is larger than it was. So, and we'll all stay within the bounds of what we need to on the issue. A Hinckley update. You know, I just want to let the board know that traditionally when we have a Hinckley item, we do a presentation with the staff and the IRP manager and PG&E as a PowerPoint. Because this evening will be such an in-depth discussion of the issue, we chose not to do that for the first time. And so instead, there's a written report in the EOPR. I just wanted to let you know that. Lake Tahoe crediting, there's a nice write-up in there as well about that. For our TMDL that we're implementing with Nevada. And the reason I wanted to highlight this is because it really is an impressive piece of work that both Nevada and our staff have been doing, working collaboratively, and not just us, with the local governments, with TRPA. For those of you that went to WQCC, you saw the City of Los Angeles talk about their new permit and how wonderful it is. It really had many elements of what we have in Lake Tahoe, but what it did not have is the crediting or the user-friendly interface that the public can have, so they could look it up themselves, which was a key element of this effort. So I know staff are very excited about this because they really worked very hard on that. And who knows, when we bring the industrial stormwater permit to the board next year, maybe Bob Larson will give you a little primer of it. I think, if you recall, I know it was a year or two, he brought just sort of a framework with this nice database was going to be, but now it's up and running, and soon they'll be loading the data and improvement, which will be able to tell us, you know, if these five projects had the load reductions that we anticipate. You'll be able to see all that on there. So it's really a neat system. I just wanted to let you know that. The other thing is, I am going to be meeting with some local officials soon up in Tahoe. That's the counties of El Dorado, Placer, and the city of South Lake Tahoe, because for the next round of the stormwater permit, they appear to be $5 million short. And so we'll be working with them to see, you know, how we can be of assistance as they try to find funding so that they're in compliance with the next round. PCE investigation. I'm going to flip now, stay in Tahoe, and flip to another issue. You may have seen the press release that we released regarding the $125,000 that we got from the cleanup and abatement account to an investigation down there for this is the Y area of South Lake Tahoe. And drill rigs are out there now working on it, hydro punching. And I just wanted to highlight that because it's where we can get money from the Clean and Bait and count and do an important investigation. Lisa Dernbach is heading up that project, and we're moving very rapidly, and so they're doing great work there. A report is due at the end of 2015 on what we're going to learn from that. And then after we learn, we'll decide what we do next. So I've given you the updates for what's in the written report. Let me give you some new information I thought you might like to know about. You heard Rich talk a little bit about the dairy strategy. What we're doing is we're going to proceed with the dairy general order for some of our active dairies in the southern part of our region. And we're having our first outreach meeting with the dairy industry, dairy farmers, actually right here, on November 19th. So I just want to let you know we're doing some public outreach on that, which is the first step of, you know, having a collaborative effort with the dairy ranchers. And the staff in the Victor office have been working very hard on this. All staff training. We try to do all staff training once a year. Every once in a while we can't, like last year, because of contracting issues. But it really is a good thing to get both the staff at the Victor office and the Tahoe office together to work on issues. This year, we focused on some health and safety training, which is a mandatory requirement. So it's always good to update everyone on that health and safety training, which we have to do quarterly. But a big focus of the training was collaborative communication techniques, both within the workplace with each other, as well as external stakeholders and external communication. We also worked a little bit on the guiding principles of the board. It's also in your packet, and staff are working on maybe bringing it back to the board in February to refine that a little bit, but also to ask questions, how do we apply the general principles? You know, how do we use them in a practical way? So that's going to be something Laura and I are going to work on over the next few months leading up to February, working with staff, to refine that a bit. Greg Bourne from UC Davis provided this training, and he also did similar training in Region 7. So Laura and I reviewed the evaluations, and we got predominantly really good reviews and appreciation from staff. But we're not done. We're going to have phase two of this, and this time I'm going to have it in the Victorville office, where the Tahoe people all go down to the Victorville office, and we're going to work on phase two of the communications. We're going to try some of the techniques that we learned and see how they work, and report back and kind of fine-tune and spend a little bit more time on external stakeholder communication. So I'll let you all know that, because you're all welcome to come to that if you find it interesting. Firefighting. And this is, again, for climate change. The LA Sanitation District wrote a letter to myself, Region 8 and Region 4, asking, can we use recycled water for firefighting, both wildfires and structural fires? And I recently sent them a letter because, you know, I can only speak to the ones within our region, which are Palmdale and Lancaster. The other regions had other plants that they will have to speak to. What we did is we told them that under the existing permit, they can use firefighting, they can use the recycled water, tertiary water, for within their service boundaries, but outside their service boundaries, it's really not within the authority of the permit. So what I did say in the letter was, and I attached a Division of Drinking Water memo. They recently gave the regions direction on this because they're getting so many requests everywhere about, hey, can we use recycled water for firefighting because there's so little water around, of some best management practices to ensure the safety of those using it and where it's applied. So I attached that memo of best management practices and rules to the LA Stand District. And what I did say to them was, you know, I would not recommend to the board that we enforce and guest you if, in case of a true emergency outside of your boundaries, you feel like you're forced to use recycled water because that's all you have, as long as you follow good practices. I am hoping, and there are dialogues with the regional boards, with the state board, saying, you know, this would be a good candidate for a general order from the state board to be uniform across the whole state, rather than region by region, permit by permit. So I just want you to know that that dialogue is going on. I have one more, and I don't know, let's see if you have my governor's executive order folder to hand out. Okay. I will find that because it was in our box at one point.
I thought it was from last time and I removed it.
Oh. Well, we'll get that to you. Governor Brown recently issued an executive order, and it's in response to the drought and wildfires to deal with the massive biomass and fuel reserves in our mountains from dead and dying trees. So this is a little bit of a piece of what Dr. Horn talked about earlier, but it's really a subset of dead and dying trees. And, of course, the emphasis there is you know, obviously safety, and many other things to get those that fuel reserve out of the mountains. But as we all know, that's not all that is easier said than done in terms of funding that's available, logistics. So the governor's executive order, was trying to streamline the efforts to remove dead and dying trees and challenge the counties and, like Caltrans, for example, to remove them in near highways where they could fall on people in areas where there could be injury to people. They also talked about creative ideas for feedstock storage, but that's another problem. If you start moving those trees, what are you going to do with them? There's also a request there for federal funds and sharing state portable equipment with locals to allow, you know, the sharing of equipment to help deal with some of this because not all locals have that kind of equipment or can they afford to buy the equipment. They're also talking about expanding prescribed burning of these stockpiles, expedite biomass siting. A lot of in the order you'll see about the PUC and things they could do to expedite the process and the permitting of these facilities. It's also asking a lot of state agencies, including CalRecycle, to get together to expand the uses for wood products. I myself actually met with CalRecycle recently, asking them how can they help us with this, you know, for the Sage Hen issue, Amy and others. Unfortunately, their charge is really only waste that goes to a landfill. This doesn't traditionally go to a landfill, of course, in case there is a wildfire and then their houses burn, and then indeed it goes to a landfill. But I see this as a tipping point. There's a lot of dialogue around the state of a needing to thin our forests. The big bugaboo is, where is the money going to come from to do that? I see that, you know, to me the good news in this order is I see the dialogue changing and the viewpoint shifting, that I'm hoping that we're reaching a tipping point where people are going to seriously start working this. My experience with executive orders, once the governor does an executive order, a framework, the legislature gets involved. Because you'll often see a bevy of legislation the next year or two implementing or expanding upon the concepts in an executive order. So you may see legislation on this next year. So that's kind of a follow-up on that. We'll get that out to you, a copy of the governor's executive order. I have two more things to mention, and I think our friends at LAD Pierce are here. I signed the Owens lake dust mitigation notice of applicability today for waste discharge warrants to dredge and fill and build wetlands for the dust mitigations in Owens Lake area. There'll be 350 acres of wetlands as a result of this. 151 acres of managed vegetation, salt removal system. Now, the project size is huge. It's over 3,400 acres, of which 2,200 will be worked on. But I just want you to know that.
Wow, that's huge.
I think it's a big move forward. N&M Dairy. As you recall, that was to the board, and we reached a stipulated agreement with them, a settlement agreement with them. And one of the aspects, if you recall, was that they were going to try to do a conservation easement. You remember? I had given them overtime extensions because they were trying to work out how to do that. Unfortunately, they've recently decided they can't pull it together for the conservation easement. And, you know, to their credit and to the credit of our staff, we really tried hard and worked together to try to see if we could pull off a conservation easement. At the end of the day, it was not possible. And it was, you know, again, it's the owner's choice. They chose not to proceed. So I sent them a motion for payment, and they're going to write a check for $188,425 to the State Board's Clinton Abatement account. I just want you to know. That concludes my report. I know if you have any questions about any of those items.
I do have maybe not a question, but I just have to point out on bait stamp 5.43, item 6, written by staff member Jen Zimmerman. United States Fish and Wildlife Services awarded $16 million in grants. Of that, $1.3 million is to acquire the Palisades Ranch in Zimmerman County. That happens to be located in Hollandale. Some of you have been there. The rest of you, I would love to take you there. It is a prime piece of riparian habitat, and with any luck, it will close escrow be acquired by the Western Rivers Conservancy by the end of November. And nothing moves fast. This has been a 7-year process, but it is made possible in great part by the required discharge of UWRA into the river. And it is one of the last bastions of riparian habitat along the river system. So it has been worthy of that lengthy effort, and I appreciate Jan pointing out the Section 6 grant funds there. I'd also like to say thank you to staff on bait stamp 5.45, item 8, the continuous collaborative effort with the Mojave River Watershed Group. This is the stormwater group in the southern Lahontan region, and The group is highly collaborative, and I think it's really important that Lahontan staff participate as, you know, a lead collaborator in that effort. So my thank you to staff for that. Are there any other comments or questions from the board? I see a question from the public.
Should I get a question from the public?
Certainly.
Regarding use of treated water to fight fires. Let's envision a reclamation plant that lets the treated water flow out of the pond in the fire department helicopter and scoops up the water and ice and fire. That's permitted?
At tertiary.
In the service area?
Yes, for Palmdale and Lancaster, because that's in their permit. For just Palmdale and Lancaster right now.
Well, I was thinking of Kern County. The Rosemont Community Services District area. They have a reclamation plant. They can flow the water into a pond. A helicopter can pick it up and fight the fire to death.
That would have to be in the permit office. I'm not sure if they're working this.
Well, this is Lori Kemper for the record. I think it. We'll have to look to see. There's a new statewide. The new statewide permit that Rosemont is actually going to be applying for. For the use of tertiary treated water. We'll have to check to see if it talks about it in that permit. Whether or not a helicopter is going to pull water out of a wastewater pond, probably not going to happen because those buckets that they, because I live in Lake Tahoe and they use those buckets to pull water out of Lake Tahoe and a lot of reservoirs in the Sierra Nevada, they're really pretty large, like 6 feet tall. And so you would you could potentially damage the liner of a sewage pond. That's typically how the helicopters operate. So the type of recycled water that gets used for firefighting, even in the Tahoe Basin where there was an exemption granted, is there's purple pipe. It's really part of the purple pipe system that's laid out for recycled water use, and those purple hydrants, the firefighters, fire trucks will go and get the water from the purple hydrant, or there's potentially they could get it from the treatment plant itself in like a big tanker truck.
And
that's more likely how it gets used.
And I have a letter with me, so I can give it to you afterwards so you can see, but here are the rules. This is under the Division of Drinking Water. You know, you can use tertiary treated recycled water for structural firefighting. This means homes, offices, buildings, and factories. You can use disaffected secondary recycled water for non-structural firefighting, forest, fields, landscapes. And Lori's correct. And there are best management practices on the fire hydrants, how to use them, how to access them. So if you would like, I'll give you this memo after the meeting. You can read. These are the parameters of using recycled water for firefighting. And like I said, Division of Drinking Water controls a lot of that in terms of how you use it because it's a public health issue.
That's a great question. Could you state for the record your name and your affiliation?
Certainly. John Joyce, published the Rosemont News.
Very good. Glad to have you. Thank you for that question. Are there any more questions or comments? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And